The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Thank you so much, Carter Glass. It's been 10 years of you serving the reading service by sponsoring Our State magazine, and we appreciate it. We turn now to the second reading of the month of Our State, Celebrating North Carolina, January 2018 edition. And we like to thank Our State periodically for sending this to the reading service so that we may read it for those of you who are blind or otherwise print impaired. The theme this month is the best of winter, and let's get to some winter. This article is entitled Students of the Slopes. On snow days, there's one class at Appalachian State University that's never canceled: ski school. For 50 years, the state's second oldest ski mountain has groomed generations of fearless, some might say foolhardy, southern skiers. Everybody did it. When you finished your turkey sandwich or chicken noodle soup or four slices of mid-afternoon pizza at Wellborn Cafeteria, you put all of your dishes on the conveyor belt, save for one very important item: the pale yellow plastic tray. You smuggled it under your coat or carted it casually under one arm, like a chemistry book. As you walked out onto Sanford Mall, you half-expectedly somebody yelled, "Stop! Put that down!" But, of course, no one ever did. So you'd continue on your way toward Bowie or Winkler or Eggers Hall, where you'd pop into your dorm room to stash the tray for later, for the mountain. You waited for a fresh blanket of snow. A full moon with a bonus had helped to see your feet as you climbed to the top of Suicide Hill or Stadium Hill or the tiered rolling lawn in front of Justice Hall. Eyes squeezed shut, you took a running start, hopped onto the tray, and let the powder and incline do the rest. You didn't hold on for dear life, because there was nothing to hold on to. It was a singular moment of joy, the kind that can only be found in those 4 years between childhood and adulthood. From January to February of 1980, 980 cafeteria trays vanished from Appalachian State's dining halls. By 1991, an average of 7,500 trays were being stolen each year, a $60,000 loss that inspired the university to sell actual sleds in the cafeteria throughout the winter. You see, as a student at App State, finding a steep snowy hill to fling yourself off of is as intrinsic to the college experience as all-nighters or regretting an 8 a.m. class. And that's largely thanks to one man and a mountain. Outside of the Swiss-inspired ski lodge at Appalachian Ski Mountain, with its charming carved wooden eaves painted the resort's signature orange, Jim Cottrell is taking another turn on the ski lift. At 72, he can carve circles around his grandkids on the slopes. For 50 years, Jim, a Boone native and Appalachian State alum, has been teaching college credit ski classes to newbies and powderheads alike, making him a kind of snow guru at the home of the mountaineers. App Ski Mountain, the state's second oldest ski resort, opened as Blowing Rock Ski Lodge in 1962. As the head of the resort's ski patrol in 1968, it didn't take Jim long to realize that most Southerners didn't know much about skiing, so he helped shape a new kind of learning experience. A year later, Jim and a partner, Jack Lester, established the French-Swiss Ski College at App Ski Mountain and set up 7 college-accredited ski programs across North Carolina. At the end of 3 years, they'd partnered with 43 schools across the Southeast. It was very popular right away, Jim says. There weren't any skiers in the South at that time, and we were offering the only program. We created many lifetime participants. It was a major part of the development of Southern skiing. By the late 80s, Jim started to see something else develop in Boone, a ski culture. The sport was influencing students to come to App State specifically for skiing, he says. The industry had time to mature with Beach Sugar and App Ski Mountain. This was the hub. It was January 1988, and snow boots, goggles, and jackets were making melty puddles in a warm corner of the App Ski Mountain Lodge. A handful of college-age instructors were kicking back, scoping out snow bunnies. It was ASU night, which met an especially high number of cute prospects. Robert Baker spotted her first. He pointed into the crowd and told his friends, "She's the one." An App State junior and second-year ski instructor, Robert had a lesson to teach that night. But when he met his group on the slopes, there she was again. Tracy. Her boyfriend introduced us, he says, laughing. She and Robert have been married for 27 years. "I knew he was special from during that first lesson, Tracy says. "What I remember the most is how hard he worked to remember each student's name, even though he called me Teresa instead of Tracy a couple of times." Robert Box. "That was just my way of flirting. It worked. In Boone, plenty of romances got their start with frozen noses and toes, and many a friendship was forged on the mountainside, too." "Oh, we had a couple of fun traditions," Robert says, "like the rivalry football game between ski instructors and ski patrol. The teams passed a football back and forth as they skied down the mountain, trying to get the ball into a trash can at the bottom." There were no rules, Robert says. You could ski over people, knock them down, tackle them. There were dog piles, broken noses, broken skis, all that. And there were late nights, too. After hours, we'd go up to the top of the mountain and sled down using whatever we could find, he says. Rafts, ski patrol sleds, lunch trays, you name it. Robert worked at App Ski until 1994, when he and Tracy moved out of state, though not before they got their 18 and 24 month sons out on the mountain. But after 16 years away, the Bakers and the 5 kids felt the pull of North Carolina again. "One day I took the boys skiing," Robert says. "I was in the lodge on my laptop and Jim walked by. He asked me, 'Do you ever think about working for us again?' The next year, in 2010, Robert returned as an instructor, and he's been there ever since." These days, App State wisely continues its practice of selling sleds in the dining halls when it snows. And in 2014, the university's landscape services planted 41 new trees on Suicide Hill, ostensibly for beautification. App Ski Mountain now features 12 slopes and 3 terrain parks, and college classes offered at the French-Swiss Ski College remain an important part of Southern skiing. From those classes, we are creating ski patrolmen and instructors, Jim says. It's a wellspring of people who go on to work in the industry. Many of those students are the second or third generation to go through the program. Both Robert and Jim often see the children of former co-workers and students on the mountain. That's the beauty of it, seeing the people who've gone on to make skiing a part of their lives, Jim says. I have grandchildren of people I taught in my classes today. Naturally, Robert's kids have been following in his tracks ever since they could fit into parkas. His 3 sons, Kellen, Ryan, and Drew, all work or worked at App School while going to school in Boone. "The best part of having a bar sitter like my dad to look up to," says Ryan, a senior at App State. For the Bakers, skiing is more than just a family tradition. It's a way to connect. The sport brought Robert and Tracy together, and it's what brought them home again. When I started back to work here, I thought I might continue for just a couple of years, Robert says, but the thrill of skiing came back to me. It was like I never left. The article was written by Katie Shantz, the assistant editor at Our State. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. There's a brief article here entitled From Bunny to Black Diamond. Our six ski areas boast plenty of opportunities for thrills and spills no matter how you like to conquer the mountain. I'm just going to touch on these shortly or briefly. The first is Sweetest Bunny Slope. That's the beginner's luck slope at Cataluchi Ski Area. It says, who are we to judge? There's no shame in preferring a mellow ride on a magic carpet conveyor belt at the top of the slope. Whether you're learning to pizza or easing in the kids, you can't go wrong with this novice hill. Next is Nostalgic Winter Fun, Youth Sledding Hill at Beach Mountain. Then a Toast to Defrost, also at Beach Mountain. The Scenic Route, Emerald Outback at Beach Mountain. Fake It Till You Make It, French Swiss Ski College, Appalachian Ski Mountain. White Knuckle Black Diamond, Whoop-Dee-Doo Ski Mountain Resort. No Skills? Big fun at Frozen Falls Tube Park in Sapphire Valley Resort. And finally, True Blues Whistling Dixie at Wolf Ridge Ski Resort. And now, a 7.6 second dream. There's a real big smile on this young man at the right-hand side. He has a Hurricanes uniform on and a hockey stick behind his neck and some really thick gloves on his hands. George Alves was only promised $500 and a jersey to suit up against Tampa Bay, but he also got the chance to live out his dream. George Alves went from washing Carolina Hurricanes jerseys to wearing one. Last season, when the team's beloved equipment manager took the ice as an emergency goalie, he didn't expect his moment of glory to last quite this long. Written by Jeremy Markovich. The moment went viral. But to George Alves, it's mostly a blur, even to this day. He remembers the score. The Hurricanes were about to lose to Tampa Bay 3-1. He remembers the coach calling his name. He remembers skating hard to the net, afraid of falling. He remembers the time left on the clock and being thankful when the puck stayed at the far end of the ice. He remembers not feeling real until reporters interview him after the game. Then he remembers feeling overwhelmed. George is an equipment manager for the Carolina Hurricanes, but last January, for 7.6 seconds, he was a goalie in the National Hockey League. Even now, it's hard to believe and hard for George to explain. It just happened, he says, smiling in his understated way, and then it was over. George's 7.6 seconds of fame was the result of a fluky alignment of circumstances. A sick goalie, a unique hockey rule, a ticking clock, and a man whose career has been built on more character than on competition. When the Hurricanes were in a pinch, they turned to their only option, a guy who'd given up his NHL ambitions a decade earlier. A guy at age 37 was in the right place at the right time. A guy they loved. They gave him a shot to realize a lifelong dream. It seemed like an improbable story. But a year later, anyone who spent time with George realizes that what happened to him wasn't improbable at all. George grew up playing high school hockey outside of Boston, but when he arrived at Camp Lejeune in 1997, he put hockey on hold. After a four-year stint in the Marines, he was eager to get back on the ice. So, on top of working full-time and taking evening classes at North Carolina State University, he began practicing with the club hockey team. As a goalie, he led the Wolf Pack to a conference championship in 2003. The following year, an NHL lockout gave him a lucky break. The Carolina Hurricanes needed a goalie to fill in during preseason workouts, and soon George found himself taking practice shots and working as the team's part-time equipment manager, even though he didn't yet know how to sharpen a pair of skates. But at 5'8" and playing in an era when a 6-foot goalie was considered short, George was never drafted. His first minor league tryout didn't work out either. Over the next few years, he was a fill-in goalie, and he ended up signing a few short contracts. His career amounted to a few dozen games for the 13 small teams across the South. During all that time, he kept helping out with the Hurricanes whenever he could, and in return, the team kept letting him skate in practices. In 2007, with a newborn daughter at home, George put his family before his dream and took a job as the equipment manager of the Twin City Cyclones in Winston-Salem. 5 years later, the Hurricanes made George full-time equipment manager. That's where he's been ever since, sharpening skates, adjusting helmets, and repairing gear. And then, on New Year's Eve 2016, George found himself on the receiving end of one of the quirkiest rules in sports. Most hockey teams carry two goalies on the roster. If one of them gets hurt or sick, and it's too close to game time for a minor league substitute to be made, make it to the arena as a backup, NHL Rule 5.3 is activated. In those rare instances, a team can use an emergency goalie, which can be practically anybody. In many cases, it's the team's goaltender coach. Often it's the first guy in town they can find, or a goalie who's played junior hockey or for a club at the local university. In modern NHL history, no emergency goalie had ever actually played in a game. George was with the Hurricanes in Tampa Bay, getting ready for a game against the Lightning that night when his phone rang. "We're looking for a goalie tonight," the assistant manager said. "It might be you." It took a minute for someone to explain what was happening. Eddie Lack, then the Hurricanes' backup goalie, had skated that morning in practice, but he was still dealing with the effects of a concussion. Trainers said he couldn't play. There was no time to fly in a backup goalie. George was handed a short-term contract to sign, one that gave him $500 and the jersey he'd wear that night. It happened so quickly that it didn't register, he says. Then things got surreal. He did a pre-game TV interview. "You are beloved by everybody in this organization, universally and completely," the interviewer told him. George looked down and smiled. "You're starting to make me emotional," he replied, his voice wavering. He led the Hurricanes into the ice for warm-ups. After the opening face-off, George went back to work, sharpening skates, taping sticks, fixing equipment, all the while wearing full goalie gear. As he plugged away, the game slipped away. The Hurricanes were down 3-1 with just seconds to go. Play stopped. George was halfway down the tunnel between the bench and the locker room trying to get a head start on packing up gear so the team could fly home to Raleigh that night. That's when the coach called his name, and he heard the words that sent his heart racing. "Get in the game!" It's been a long, bewildering year since that moment. The Carolina Hurricanes started selling T-shirts with George's name on the back. His Massachusetts hometown made him Grand Marshal of their 4th of July parade. "I don't even know what I'm doing here, to be honest with you," he said from the back of the Cadillac convertible. The Carolina Mudcats baseball team asked him to serve as a volunteer bullpen catcher. And some of George's game-worn hockey gear is slated for display at the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Quantico, Virginia. He responds dutifully to the fan mail that arrives daily, even now at his home in Natedale. "I've caught myself saying, 'You don't want my autograph,'" George says. Even after a year of attention, he's not sure how to take it. His job as equipment manager always comes first, but after he's finished with everyone else's gear, he puts on his own, skates under the ice, and tries to block shot after shot from the NHL's finest. Some he can't see because the hulking Hurricanes player is standing in front of him. Some he can't anticipate because they're coming at 90-plus miles per hour. A lot of shots go into the net. A lot of hit George in the worst places. He's getting beat up out there. George is a confidence builder, isn't he? Jokes a guy watching practice from the stands. He's right. George will stay late so that another player can work out some kinks or get a few shots in on a live goalie. He'll take the punishment so that the team's two rostered goaltenders don't have to. For 14 years, George has practiced on and off with these guys because he loves hockey and because he wants others to get better. He gets no extra money for throwing himself in front of sizzling slap shots, but the pain is worth it for the team's sake. I don't have to get ready for a game, he says. They do. Article by Jeremy Markovich. He's a senior writer and editor of Our State. We've heard many of his articles. And now we are, I'm trying to figure out what we're going to read next and whether we have time for it, because I ran out to the end here, and I haven't marked how long these articles are. So let's go back here previously in the magazine and read an article by my very favorite author, Drew Perry. It's under the moniker We Live Here, a father and his two young sons pieced together a patchwork of North Carolina memories. Year of the Dog. Starting the new year off right means opening yourself to fresh possibilities, especially the furry, wagtailed kind. Adventures with Toad and Wee. By Drew Perry. There's a dog I can't show you, my wife said one afternoon last summer, handing me her phone, refusing to look me in the eye. We had one rule for the dog search we were pretending we weren't really conducting. Under no circumstances could the new dog look anything like our old dog, my grad school dog, a dog who saved my life many times, over and over, and who loved my wife in an immutable gravitational way. Well, before I would admit to myself that I did too. That dog lived to be 17. Our fear was that if the new dog looked too much like the old dog, we'd hate her for being a ghost. I clicked on the pictures. This dog was eerily littermate similar. Orange and white, a collie mix, a whiff of Carolina dog, a hint of coyote. Slightly less wild-looking than the first dog, but there was the unmistakable sense that she might be haunting us just the same. We can never go meet this dog, I told my wife. Definitely not, she said. Emergency, the Craigslist ad read. Urgent need for adoption. I was on the phone an hour later, lying to the rescue woman, saying of course my boys were calm. The kids had wanted a snake. Failing that, a kitten. I wanted them to grow up knowing dogs. But after two nights of new dog hiding under the laundry table in our loud house, growling at anyone who went in there, I was settling into a low-grade state of panic. Had we made a mistake? Could you bring an adult dog of unknown history into a house with two feral boys? Could you do this in 2017, the year of I'm telling, the year of he's copying me? Could you do it all without getting their faces bitten off? The answer, it turns out, is no. New dog nipped, the Wee, our four-year-old, about a week in. The circumstances? A PB&J being ferried across the kitchen. No stitches, but still. The Toad, our second grader, was freaked out. We were freaked out. The Wee, who was made of cinder blocks and blind, foolish hope, was unmoved. He never cared all that much, never knew to get fully spooked, never stopped putting his face in hers, even after we begged him to stop. And it was he who won her over, not me, dog whispering in the night in the laundry room. Within 2 weeks, that child was using her as a pillow. She was letting him. The downside of a biggish dog, if you're four, you can't quite walk her. The benefit? She's almost your size, and as soon as you both draw your lines in the sand and make your secret silent deals, you can lie right down on her. I'm sure that 2018 will still be the year of I hit him because he destroyed my Legos, but it's still also for us, for these boys, the year of the dog. We've been letting her off leash a little bit, and in hopes of beach runs and Appalachian hikes. I remember all this, the off-kilter peace that arrives with having a beast in the house. What I don't remember, though, and what I couldn't, right now as I write this, the wee is dragging new dog around the hardwoods on a sleeping bag, shrieking and laughing. She's happily in the game. Her ghost sister probably disapproves. New dog is more playful, more dog-like, more insistent upon affection than the first dog ever was. Old dog would disdain this base domestication. But I'll bet she'd allow for the toad wandering downstairs after bedtime, hair all over the place and squinting in the light of the magazine, no longer afraid and needing to give new dog one more pat before he falls asleep. I bet she'd approve of the wee nuzzling deeper into the new dog's belly fur. All of this is old dog's fault, after all. She kept me glued together through some hard, hard years. She glued my wife and me together for what's looking a lot like forever. Not so bad, then, if new dog reminds us of all of that, gives us past and present and future all at once. These boys, a dog, a new year, old acquaintances, indeed. And finally, we live here, gathering place in Asheville, Game On, one of North Carolina's first board game cafes. Well played, serves up nostalgic fun, unplugged. There's a picture here of three young men at a table. One of them's taking notes. One of the others is studying a board. It's Scrabble. You can say it looked like Scrabble, but here's the cover to it. And then there's somebody along for emotional support beside the guy who's involved with the play here. The caption says, "Can't decide what to play? A game master can help you find the perfect fit and will even explain the rules." Well played is, by its very nature, noisy. Shouts of victory and groans of despair. A taboo buzzer. A collapsing Jenga tower. Yahtzee dice cluttering on our table. The Board Game Cafe, Asheville's first, is like something out of a childhood dream. Players old and young peruse shelves stocked with more than 500 games, from classic like Scrabble to modern like Apples to Apples. At wide wooden tables, they snack on cookies, popcorn, and charcuterie, sip on coffee, hot chocolate, and, when a celebration requires it, champagne. In the iPhone age, the concept may seem like a blast from the past, but co-owner Courtney Mercer disagrees. Technology, he says, creates isolation. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.